Now, from the left coast to the D.C. Beltway, covering the topics you love to hate and hate to miss, it's the Silk or Joe Show.
Welcome, everybody, to the Silk or Joe Show. Co-host Joe here today with you all. Happy to have you this Saturday afternoon. And we actually have a guest joining us in this first segment to talk about zombie executive orders. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, just want to thank the various folks that makes this show possible, the Main Street Radio Network, for example. We might disagree with management over content, but they always have our backs. Happy to have them with us. And we want to thank the Salem Radio Network for distributing the show. Main Street Radio Network can be found at mainstreetradionetwork.com. And you'll also find them on social media, Facebook, Main Street Radio Network, Twitter, Main Street Radio. And don't forget the Al and Nathan Show, which airs on weekdays, 5 to 7. So you can just go to mainstreetradionetwork.com and listen in there. That's usually the best way these days, you know, with how convenient everyone has the internet right there on their phones, ready to stream whenever. But you can also find more about that show at alandnathan.com. And you can find them on Twitter, Al and Nathan. But you can find this show. We don't have a Twitter page. We are on Getter, GETTR.com, at Silk or Joe Show. And speaking of the Al and Nathan Show, our guest here was actually on earlier this week about this topic. We are joined now by Jonathan Emerd, constitutional attorney, columnist for USA Today magazine, and co-host of the Sacred Fire of Liberty Hour on the Robert Scott Bell Show. Jonathan, happy to have you. How are you today?
Great to be with you, Joe. Doing well.
All right. So we're talking now, actually, something going on in my home state of Virginia, where I'm broadcasting from at this moment, where apparently the ABC there has just gone nutso and decided to go and do an armed raid of a restaurant. What was that all about?
Last Friday, the ABC had the police go to a restaurant called Gourmelt's in Fredericksburg, Virginia, owned by Matt Strickland, a combat veteran from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And they came in, some 20, 25 police, and confiscated all of the alcohol in his business, as well as imaged all the hard drives of his computer system. And that's, as you know, in a restaurant business, when you seize the alcohol, you seize the most valuable asset and the one that they profit from. So, in other words, you consign them to death as a business if they can't sell alcohol. So they were enforcing a court order, which was obtained to enforce what is a defunct executive order from the prior governor, Governor Ralph Northam, who is a Democrat, and it's his COVID-19 lockdown order that was issued on December 14th of 2020 and was withdrawn in May of 2021. Yet here we are in December of 2022, and that order is the order that underlies all this and is being enforced by this action.
And just occurred to me, for those of you outside the state of Virginia, the Virginia ABC is the Virginia Alcoholic Beverage Control Authority. So just the fact that they showed up with an armed SWAT team, well, that's a lot of power for alcoholic beverage control there. But this is why they at least would have authority to do this if that executive order were valid, theoretically. But how did the court miss that this executive order was withdrawn?
Well, I didn't represent my client, Matt Strickland, at the time. I wish I had. But in any event, the case went against him, and it's an abuse of power. A withdrawn executive order leaves the board with no power to proceed, yet they did anyway. They continued their prosecution, and they ultimately got a judgment against him and proceeded to enforce it. All the while, the underlying authority was not there. Even were it there, it was highly dubious, because what we're talking about are completely arbitrary and capricious rules. So, for example, under that same executive order, no Virginia resident could leave their house between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. That's patently unconstitutional. The other provision in issue here is also ridiculous, because they prohibited the restaurant from serving alcohol or allowing customers to be in the premises after 10 p.m., as if COVID somehow is seriously present at 10 p.m. and later. But not during the rest of the day. And as far as the customers in the restaurant were concerned, they limited the number of customers, and they also required the tables to be 6 feet apart, even though this is a well-ventilated restaurant, and there's no evidence whatsoever that people have contracted COVID there. And so, anyway, it's utterly absurd to enforce this against this man. And so the governor has acted at our behest. We petitioned the governor. He acted also in response, I'm sure, to the enormous public reaction to this, which has been very negative against what the ABC did. And he did something profound. He ordered the ABC and all other agencies in Virginia to supply proof of all of their enforcement of the Northam orders. And he is going to introduce, as part of his budget resolution, an amendment that would require reimbursement of the penalties, fines, and so forth imposed under these orders, as well as reinstatement of licenses like Matt Strickland's license to sell alcohol. So that's a very positive development.
Well, then for Mr. Strickland, did this case start before the executive order got withdrawn? Is that why they continued with it? Or did they just suddenly?
Okay. It started, their activity in this matter started before, 2 months before the governor withdrew his order. However, after the withdrawal of the order, they did not stop. They just continued to enforce the withdrawn order. And that begs the ultimate question. If a governor withdraws an executive order, does the administrative state have the power to continue indefinitely to enforce that order, or must they abide by the governor's order if they were, in the first instance, implementing the governor's order? And so it begs a question that I think has to be answered in this way. If the governor withdraws an order, the agency has no power to continue enforcement predicated upon it. Otherwise, governors would have no power to stop actions they commenced, and that would cause them to be reluctant to commence any action that may be necessary. In this case, what the governor Northam did was utterly absurd and very destructive, ruinous to businesses. And Matt had the courage and commitment not to do it. He came back from being a combat veteran. He said at the start of this that, look, I didn't go to Afghanistan and Iraq to fight for American freedom only to come home and have it taken away. I'm not going to abide by an arbitrary order that takes away my freedom. And that was his position at the start of this.
As it turns out, an arbitrary and anti-science order as well that they would continue to enforce even after it's been redacted. But does that raise the question about sort of an ex post facto thing here, I guess? Because I thought that only meant that if a law is changed, then you're not allowed to be prosecuted after the fact if you committed a crime before it. But does that apply here technically?
The problem with this is that the whole order is predicated on an emergency, and the governor mm-hmm. determines whether the emergency is present or not. And in this case, the subsequent governor has determined definitively and has stated publicly as his reason for this, that it was unjust, it never should have been imposed, that people's liberties were violated, essentially, if you read his public statement. That's the gist of it, and that he's not going to tolerate it, and that he expects those licenses to be restored and those fines to be remitted, that he wants the legislature to find a financial mechanism to reimburse those people who are fined. It's a recognition that this was a wholly arbitrary and capricious action by the prior administration. And Governor Youngkin has repudiated those prior actions and has rejected the bases for them. In any event, what you have is a question of enforcement discretion. And anyone who is reasonable, looking at the fact that the pandemic in Virginia is gone, we're in the endemic phase in Virginia, and looking at the length of time from the withdrawal of the order to the time they took enforcement action by seizing his alcohol, which is from May of 2021 to December of 2022, you would say, no, this is a draconian imposition of enforcement based on the fact that there is no necessity for action now. And that's what they should have done, and they should have recognized that their power was removed, but they didn't.
Yeah, instead they sent armed local police, armed special agents from the Virginia Alcohol Beverage Control Authority, just tore into the place and raided it, as you talked about at the beginning of the segment, for a defunct law, or executive order anyway. Crazy. Jonathan Emer, constitutional attorney, appreciate you being on the Soaker Joe Show. Listeners, we got more coming up after this break.
Preparing for game day is critical, especially during football season when legendary sportscaster Gus Johnson spends more time on the road than at home. Gus shares his favorite travel tip to help you prepare for the next big game on your schedule.
Road games are always the most challenging because of the unfamiliar environment. When preparing for game day, it's important to choose a hotel that provides comfort and support to help maintain your routine. Regardless of where my travels take me during the season, I know that a Hampton by Hilton will be nearby and can always count on their reliable, friendly service and amenities to help me perform at my best. With the space to comfortably work and sleep just the way you want, Hampton hotels are fully equipped with all the essentials to ensure you are always ready to tackle your big game. And the free breakfast featuring signature make-your-own waffles will give you the energy needed for an MVP performance.
For more information and to plan your next stay, go to HamptonByHilton.com.
Whether you're celebrating a special anniversary, a life milestone, or a baby on the way, Kay, Jared, and Zales have so many meaningful ways to honor your relationship this holiday season, whether you're shopping in-store or online. And one gift sure to wow is the new Love Entwined collection from Kay. It features a signature center diamond and interlinking design that represents your hearts forever intertwined by love. And I'm also loving Jared's Shy Creation diamond ring, a modern way to symbolize the interwoven fabric of your love with fashion-forward stacked bands. And finally, the You're the One collection from Zales features pieces with stunning center stones to represent and celebrate that one person who's your everything. Head on over to kjaredandzales.com and don't forget that experts are available online and in-store to help you find that perfect gift. And shop smart, order online for quick in-store pickup.
My name is Judy Teeter, and I'm the mother of three boys. My youngest, Joe, was a great kid. He loved sports, music, and his youth group. One day, Joe asked me to drive him to an after-school event, which was about a mile from our home. I was driving through a green light when a car in cross traffic ran a red light and drove right into the side of our car, killing Joe. The driver was talking on her phone, so she never even saw the red light. She was so absorbed in her phone call. Before the crash, I didn't realize just talking on a cell phone while driving was so dangerous. Now it's something I think about every day. According to the National Safety Council, about 1 in 4 car crashes involves a cell phone. Hands-free is no safer. When you're behind the wheel, put away your phone. For Joe and for the thousands of needless deaths every year. Remember, there is no safe way to talk on a cell phone while driving. Find out more at nsc.org/callskill.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give him a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve. It's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Silk or Joe Show, everybody. Went from talking about defunct laws to new laws coming into play. Over in Oregon's past election, they had a ballot measure 114. Did certain things with the gun laws. Right now, it's in a sort of legal limbo. It was supposed to go into effect Thursday. But instead, there was a sort of, injunction is the word for it. I don't want to get the words wrong here. Basically, a lower court decided this law couldn't go into effect right away. Something's really horrible with it. And the state attorney general appealed to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court said, no, the lower court's ruling stands. So now Oregonians don't have this ballot measure that they voted for implemented yet. But what does it do? It's very interesting, the stuff in there. It says here, quote, the availability of firearms, including semi-automatic assault rifles and pistols with accompanying large-capacity ammunition magazines, pose a grave and immediate risk to the health, safety, and well-being of the children of the citizens of this state, particularly our youth. So it doesn't just include assault weapons, as whatever the heck that means, because they have no idea what assault weapons are. It's a broadly defined term that they have. And also pistols. It's not just those, though. It just says the availability of firearms, including these specific ones, but the availability of firearms in general are a threat to the public, according to the very words of this amendment or this ballot measure here. In other words, the Second Amendment is a threat, according to this ballot measure that Oregonians voted to pass. As you can imagine, this is a bit of an unconstitutional thing to do, isn't that? To try and pass something that directly goes after the Second Amendment. What's next? The First Amendment? And here's another quote from it. Oregon currently has no permit requirements for purchasing a semi-automatic assault firearm or any other type of weapon. And that permit is actually the Second Amendment and the Tenth Amendment that stops states from going against the Constitution. So, again, they say outright the availability of firearms pose a grave and immediate risk to the health, safety, and well-being of the citizens of this state, particularly our youth. Exact text from there, exact quote from this measure. They think the Second Amendment is a threat to their citizens and their children in particular. And, of course, they say that they need a permit process. That's what this ballot measure is there to establish. It also bans high-capacity magazines. Just over any magazines that carry more than 10 rounds are not allowed. So how do they go about doing this? All this, though, it says that you need for the permit process, you have to go to your local police chief or county sheriff. That's what it says, quote, police chief or county sheriff, unquote. Now, the problem is, though, for those of you keeping up with law enforcement situations across the country, in Oregon, they are understaffed and underfunded all across the board. In fact, they've had to have some state officials go from state troopers, their equivalent thereof. I'm not sure what they call them up there. They've actually had to have them come and substitute in some areas for law enforcement measures because there's just not enough police officers. So that means you, the citizen, if you want a firearm, you have to go to the police chief or county sheriff, the head of this underfunded, understaffed organization, as if he isn't busy enough, as if he's going to have the time for it. And not only that, but it's referred to here after they call him police chief or county sheriff, that is referred to as the permit agent from this point on, to make it simple. So they must thoroughly investigate you, the police chief or county sheriff. They're given some authority to allow their departments to outsource that investigation to their departments, but still, they're the ones who are at the top, who are the labeled permit agent by this measure. In other words, it falls on them to make time in their schedule for you. So if you want a gun, you gotta go to the police chief or county sheriff to get this permit. And these very, very busy individuals. Even in a fully staffed environment, these would be very busy people, between handling staff issues, handling public appearances, begging the legislature for the proper equipment that they need, talking to the mayor about how they can help out with whatever, coordinating disaster relief, all sorts of stuff. The police chief is a very busy person. The county sheriff, a very busy person. And that's when they are fully staffed. Again, this is Oregon, though, that we're talking about, where they are severely understaffed and severely underfunded. And they're the ones who have to make time for you to get a gun purchase. Do you really think that they have time for that, right? This is I think it's Oregon, yeah, Portland, where they say they can't really investigate rapes any longer because their police, they just don't have the manpower for it. But surely they can investigate you for the permit process. They have time, first of all, to even hear your permit request and then have time to thoroughly investigate you, because this does require a detailed investigation of you, the individual. The police chief or the county sheriff actually has to evaluate whether or not you are mentally stable, has to look into your background and all of that. So that they have a lot on their hands from this permitting process, and they simply don't have the time for that sort of thing. But then, assuming somehow you get through all that, you got to pay for that too, by the way. $65 is the max, but you do have to pay for this to happen. But then you also have to find a firearms training course with a law enforcement certified instructor. The police, they have a hard enough problem finding law enforcement certified instructors for themselves. So good luck to you, but you got to pay for that as well, whatever class that is. Oh, and by the way, for this permit process, you got to renew it every 5 years. You got to renew this permit every 5 years. So every 5 years, you have to go to your county sheriff or police chief or whatever and say, hey, I need this renewed. Then they got to do it all over again. And you got to pay all over again. Otherwise, those firearms you've had for the last 5 years are suddenly illegal and you can be arrested. And none of this makes anyone safer, mind you. The RAND Corporation, they did a study about this sort of thing, found that none of this helps. Plus, even under this new law, the only if you're thinking, well, at least a gun safety class is helpful, well, not really, because all it does is make sure you can load, unload, and aim and fire in a safe manner. That's it. That's the minimum requirement. You have to demonstrate that before the instructor in order to get the permit authorization there. So that's what any mass shooter would do, right? It's not anything at all related to reducing gun casualties or anything like that. And the permits are supposed to go into an electronic registry as well, but it doesn't say anything about whether or not these registries are public or private. There's nothing in there about it. Now, rumors are a public registry will happen, but it's in private. We don't know. Sorry, I was misreading what I had written out here in my notes about this measure. So we don't know if this registry is going to be public. We don't know if a rapist is going to be like, okay, well, I've been stalking this person for a while. Let me check the publicly available registry. Oh, they are unarmed. Perfect. Or some criminal who's like, boy, I really need to steal a firearm for my next crime. Let's see, this person has a couple and they're going to stalk them for a while. Oh, they haven't been home for a little bit. Okay, well, there's a gun in the house. I'm going to go get it. So none of that. That might be possible. Who knows? It's not said. It's very vague on that term because it just says an electronic database. That's all it calls for. It doesn't say who can access it or when. Oh, and another thing, a quote from this measure, a permit to purchase issued under this section does not create any right of the permit holder to receive a firearm. So you take, what, a year to go through this entire process and you still don't have an actual right to have a gun. But wait a minute. The Constitution says you do. So this thing automatically annuls your right to have a firearm. It says it right here. Does not create a right of the permit holder to receive a firearm. More Soaker Joe show after this break.
Legendary Hall of Fame quarterback Joe Montana has spent a lifetime making healthy decisions. After being on Medicare for the past year, he wants to help others make their next play when choosing a Medicare plan.
I turned 65 last year, and I've been taking care of myself with healthy meals, activities I enjoy, getting plenty of sleep, and staying connected to friends and loved ones. But a funny thing about reaching this age, you know what you want. You have little patience for nonsense and inefficiencies.
Montana wants other seniors to take the time to review their options ahead of the December 7th deadline.
I found Medicare to be very complex. Understanding when to enroll and which type of plan to choose was complicated and confusing. Ultimately, I assessed my options and chose WellCare. They helped me remove the hassles of signing up for a plan and offered me the benefits I wanted. I encourage others to take the time to find the right one for your needs and budget.
To talk to a broker, visit Medicare.gov, or to learn more about WellCare, visit WellCareNow.com. Spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA, is a leading genetic cause of infant death. If left untreated, it can lead to progressive muscle weakness, paralysis, and in its most severe forms, permanent ventilation or death in 90% of cases by the age of 2 years. Diagnosing and treating SMA quickly is crucial to stopping progression of the disease, and treatments have advanced significantly in the past decade. Patients now have 3 FDA-approved options available. Patients and caregivers should talk to their doctor about options before deciding what is right for them. SMA parent advocate Hannah Weaver.
When we welcomed our son Payne into the world, we were shocked when he was diagnosed with SMA at only 5 days old through our state's newborn screening program. He seemed perfectly healthy. Without newborn screening, we would not have known anything was wrong until the disease had done irreparable harm to his body. We are thankful we were able to pursue treatment for Payne so quickly, but not every family is as lucky as we are. That's why I'm passionate about educating families about the signs of SMA and advocating for nationwide newborn screening for SMA.
For more information about SMA and to learn more about the benefits of early diagnosis and treatment, visit curesma.org. That is curesma.org. This segment is sponsored by Novartis Gene Therapies.
The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. At Children International, we know that the journey to end poverty for good begins first with a child. It starts with their first checkup, lesson, opportunity, job. That journey takes commitment from people like you and me to end poverty for good. Learn more at children.org.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show. If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned. Accessible homes and vehicles. And access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at PVA.org.
All right, welcome back to the Silk or Joe Show. We're still talking about Oregon's ballot measure 114, restricting your ability to obtain firearms. Again, the quote that I ended the last segment with from that measure is, quote, "A permit to purchase issued under this section does not create any right of the permit holder to receive a firearm," unquote. In other words, if that ballot measure passes, you have to get a permit to have a firearm, but still going through that process, spending, what, $200 for classes and for the fee to even have them look at your case or whatever to begin with. and also hounding relentlessly the police chief or county sheriff, the only two people allowed to give you a permit to begin with, hounding those very busy individuals for one. You go through that process, take a year, $200 out of your life just to do that. And it doesn't even give you the right to have a firearm in the first place. So by the fact that it says it does not create any right of the permit holder to receive a firearm, that means there is no right of the permit holder to have a firearm, at least according to this reading. So that's sort of a barrier there that they're putting in place that's stopping low-income people from obtaining firearms, because you have to go through all this process, jump through all these hoops, and if you are struggling, lower class, homeless or whatever, how are you going to do any of this stuff, right? Our guns are already expensive enough. Okay, the cheapest ones, for example, are like $120 or so. Very lousy, and not exactly the best thing for self-defense. Really just best thing for if you've never fired a gun before. They're just that low quality. So, but already $120 right there. $65 for the permit process. So already that's $185. I think there was another fee in there too, but didn't write a note about it. But then you also have the education course. That it's not like those things are free. Those cost money. So just say a blanket $100 for that as well. So now you're already at $285 just to get, oh, taxes as well. So we'll make that even it out at $300. So $300 to obtain just the most basic firearm possible. Plus you have to take time out of your schedule. If you're lower class, lower income, maybe you're working two jobs just to stay afloat. Well, when are you going to do this? When are you going to take these classes? It's not like you're going to have weekends available. And by even the evenings, you're probably going to be just too tired to do it. But this also means you live in a high crime area, most likely, not just poverty and low and crime go together, unfortunately. So that means that you need one desperately, but you're priced out of the market for getting one. Not only that, but you just don't have the time to go and find and pursue the local police chief for pursue the classes. Just don't have any time for that. So automatically, this is a very classist ballot measure that the Oregonians voted for, that the Democrats hoisted upon them. Because Democrats do run the state of Oregon. They won all the elections. So it makes sense that the same people voting Democrat would support this measure would be, and this measure would be a Democrat-backed measure. That's why I'm attributing authorship to it. Well, also, this left-wing organization was behind pushing it to begin with. So it's a very classist thing, though. And if you're a Democrat, you also generally believe that whites have a higher income than non-whites. So this is also racist, because this measure prevents non-whites from getting firearms. Now, I could have sworn that non-whites were the target of white supremacy in this country, right? CNN labels the white whites as the biggest terrorist threat. And there's the FBI and DOJ saying that whites are the biggest terror threat that the country faces. So how come you're passing this measure here that's going to stop the non-whites from getting any kind of defense measures for themselves? Kind of racist of you, as well as classist. Great job, Oregon. But it's not exactly the first time that they've dumped into the racist market with themselves. And it also follows a general theme with them as well. The other time that they recently, where they went into the area of being totally abhorrently racist. So the general theme is this: they see a problem and they decide the people aren't to blame exactly. Instead, it's the tools or whatever. So in this case, well, people aren't to blame for the rising gun violence. It's just the fact that there are guns out there. Well, that's not true, because 100 years ago or even 80 years ago, right after any of the major wars, the U.S. government, eager to ditch its firearms, just dumped them wherever they could, and you could buy them real cheap. Actual weapons of war, mind you, like the M1 Garand, for example, from World War II. I was reading earlier today about how right after the war, you could buy $25. I don't know what that translates to in today's dollars, mind you, but $25 back in 1945 or 46, because the government had such a big surplus of them after the war. And you could just go to your local store and buy them. And also, they were not just available in specialized gun stores. They were available in the general stores, I get, don't know what the equivalent for you kids these days would be, like a 7-Eleven or something, I guess, maybe, or the a very small Walmart, perhaps. So these were available everywhere, and there was no background check or anything like that. So you'd think if violence in society, if guns were the problem and not people, that it would have been the freaking Wild West or something all the way up until the 70s or the 80s, right? Because kids were also allowed to bring their guns to school. There'd be a pile of them in the back of the classroom in some cases. In fact, in Alaska, that still happens because for the same reason, too. Kids go hunting after school. That's how they get their food. So in that environment, why weren't there more mass shootings? Why weren't there more school shootings with all the guns readily accessible right there for anyone to go nuts with? That's not the problem being addressed, though. The problem that what the Democrats decide to address is not why were we more responsible with guns 50 years ago. Rather, they just say, let's just get rid of the guns because we're no longer responsible enough for them as a society anymore somehow. Even though we've made such great progress against fighting racism or whatever, somehow we've regressed as far as being violent goes. We've become more violent somehow. But who cares about that? Let's not look at why that's happening. Instead, let's just get rid of the guns and pretend that everything else is fine. So that's the attitude that they pursued also, as I mentioned before, in another area in Oregon, where with math, the Oregon, I've talked about this before, Oregon public school systems, they decided, hey, we're not going to bother teaching math because it's racist, or because, well, not racist. They said it because non-whites underperformed, therefore we're just not going to teach it. Instead of figuring out why non-whites are underperforming, they just said, structural, systemic racism, whatever, we'll just stop teaching math so the kids can get out of school and graduate. But it's like, graduating without knowing math kind of defeats the purpose of graduating, doesn't it? Because graduating means that you obtained a certain level of education. It's not, graduating itself is not the reward. Graduating symbolizes that you have obtained all these skills that you were supposed to get up until now. But that's not how Oregon sees it. They just see graduation itself as the thing to strive for. So it doesn't matter that you learn nothing on the way there. Doesn't matter if you can read or write as badly as you did when you were 6 years old, when you're 18. Just graduating is the end-all, be-all of education, according to their theory here. And again, they said that because non-whites were underperforming, just ditch math altogether. Don't bother figuring out why non-whites are underperforming. Just lower the standard for everyone else to that point. And that's what they're doing with guns. Don't figure out why people are shooting each other more than they ever did before. Instead, just lower the standard. No one, obviously, we can't behave anymore, so we'll just take the guns away. And again, who's impacted, as I mentioned before, largely minorities, because especially if you're a Democrat, if you think that a black person cannot obtain a voter ID, then, or any kind of ID to vote, that is, you know, whether it's your driver's license or just a government-issued ID, if you think they can't do that, what makes you think that they can go to the police chief, who is a racist against them, according to Democrat theory, anyway, and apply for the permit to get a gun, and also take all these classes and pay all this money, because also, remember, income inequalities are very poor people. So it's just hurting the minority communities is what they're doing by their own theories about how the world works. And on top of that, they're also saying, well, we're not going to bother teaching them math. So you've disarmed them. You left them without any kind of math skills or whatever. So they can't get a job. All they have to turn to is crime. You wonder why you're going to have a surge of illegal gun usage if this law passes. Well, there you go. Because, again, ignorance breeds crime. How else are you going to get by in society if you don't know how to get by in society? You break the rules. And that's what we see a lot in other Democrat-ran cities that they've ran into the toilet. Chicago, for example, they blame all their crimes on all their gun crimes on people going out of town to get guns or whatever. Well, okay, these are the same people, first of all, that you say are too stupid to get a state ID or a driver's license. So how are they smart enough to bypass your strict gun control laws? But also, they're just doing something illegally because, well, the city has just ran so poorly that these folks are in perpetual poverty. And after many decades of government of Democrat rule, the city, they're still there. Now, as far as Democrat politicians go, though, they're perfectly happy with you not having a firearm. In fact, Congresswoman Cori Bush, one of the many far leftists in Congress, by the way, this election, 90% of socialist candidates won their races. So that should be a warning there, statistics provided by the Heartland Institute. But Cori Bush, she outright said, defund the police, get rid of your guns, but it's okay for her to have armed security because she faces threats and you obviously don't. So, like, they don't even see you as being threatened in any way, so that's why they're okay with keeping guns out of your hands, but being surrounded by private security, and also keeping police away from you. Folks, more Silk or Joe Show coming up after this break.
More than 5 million teeth are knocked out every year, but only 9% of adults in the U.S. know what to do if it happens. Following the right steps can save the tooth. Here's Stefan Eiswag, DDS, president of the American Association of Endodontists, AAE.
If you knock out a tooth, pick it up by the crown, gently rinse it with water, and reposition it into the socket immediately. A second option is to put it in milk. Bring the tooth to a dentist or endodontist as soon as possible.
According to AAE's latest survey, 3 in 4 Americans are committed to doing everything they can to preserve their natural teeth, even though more than half are not going to the dentist every 6 months as recommended.
Oral health care is more than just vanity. It impacts overall health. While the majority of Americans realize gum disease and oral cancer may be tied to poor oral health, most people don't identify heart attacks and strokes as possibly linked to poor oral care.
Save your natural teeth. Find an endodontist near you at findmyendodontist.com.
During the holidays in particular, I always tell my clients, keep it simple. You know, keep them on their normal food and find different ways to shower them with love. So whether that's spending a little extra time on walks or giving them some new toys, there are ways to make your dog feel extra special that don't necessarily involve food. There are some definite watch outs during the holiday season when it comes to pet safety. So the first would be, you know, we all think holidays, immediately think food. So we need to make sure that those table scraps are staying away from our pets, particularly things like turkey skin, bones, you know, grapes, chocolate, all of onions, garlic. Those are going to be super important to avoid. Also making sure that, you know, when you work in your home, and I love to decorate my home. So making sure, you know, things like garland and ornaments and, you know, plants and poinsettias and floral arrangements, those are all out of jaws reach from our pets. But if you are looking for more tips or just a refresher on what we talked about today, head over to healthspet.com/small dog.
What is dedication?
I am the father of a 9-year-old little girl and a 6-year-old little boy. And I find fatherhood both relentlessly challenging and relentlessly rewarding. My daughter is biological and my son is adopted. I love them both so much. From the morning when you wake up to putting them to bed at night, and every moment in between, it really is so special, and boy, is it exhausting. One thing that I fear about being a parent is the future for my children. I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings. But I'm also hopeful that the future holds a more inclusive and compassionate world for them.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
My baby brother, a father.
Come on, it's time for his nap.
Whoa, he can't sleep on his stomach. Babies should always sleep on their backs in a safety-approved crib, and the sleep area should be clear of blankets, toys, and other loose or soft items. It reduces the risk of SIDS.
SIDS?
You know, sudden infant death syndrome.
Guess I need to start studying up on safe sleep for little man here. Being his favorite uncle comes with big responsibilities.
For more information, visit safetosleep.nichd.nih.gov. Sponsored by the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. You want to give your baby everything, so start with a safe sleep area. Babies younger than one should always be placed to sleep on their backs on a firm and flat surface, like a safety-approved crib. And keep blankets, pillows, and other soft or loose items out of the crib when the baby is in it. Learn more about safe sleep for babies at safetosleep.nichd.nih.gov. Sponsored by the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for sticking with us through the Silk Road Joe Show today. We are wrapping up now with Bryn Hamacek, co-founder of Common Ground Campus and a member of Human Events Media Group. He is co-author with the late Dr. Vladimir Zelenko of Zelenko, How to Decapitate the Serpent. Brent, happy to have you. How are you today?
I couldn't be any better. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So let's get right down into it. The book, Zelenko, How to Decapitate the Serpent. It looks like a very wide-ranging book. Tell us about it.
Well, it is a bit wide-ranging, and it's wide-ranging because Zev himself was a wide-ranging person. You know, he was a family physician, he was a philosopher, and he was a national advocate for patients' rights and health. And so you can't write a book that isn't a bit wide-ranging. But so your listeners know, if they buy the book, and certainly hope they will, they'll find a book that's written in three parts. The first part is designed to let them get to know Zev personally, understand his journey with cancer that he went through the last few years of his life, and understand his philosophy. The middle section of the book we call the COVID storm, and it tells the story of starting back in early 2020, how as a family physician in upstate New York, he started to see patients getting sick and dying, and he went on a quest to try to find a way to treat them, which he did. He was the first person in the world to come up with an effective treatment for the pandemic. And then what he encountered over the next 2 years in terms of government resistance, pushback from the medical community, the pharmaceutical community, the mainstream media, it tells that entire story. In the final section of the book, we call Making the Case, Zev was known for three things, one of which was coming up with a treatment, the other of which was arguing that this was a man-engineered virus, and finally arguing very strenuously against the vaccine. And so what we do in the last part of the book is we make those three cases. And so I think your listeners, if they read it, will find it to be pretty good read, and it moves around a bit, right? So it's not just some simple life chronology. There's a lot of content there.
Mm-hmm. A lot of content, a lot of current events, and a lot of warnings about the future, it seems, and how these power abuses that have happened so far, how they affected actual treatments of COVID from getting out there.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, Zev had this figured out by the middle of March of 2020. So just as the lockdowns were starting, he had unlocked a way to treat people. The problem with this treatment is that it was very effective, very affordable, and nobody was going to be able to make any money from it, not real money. And that's where you weren't going to be able to exercise control over an entire globe of people if you could treat them early for a disease and get them better within a matter of hours. So what he discovered, the use of hydroxychloroquine combined with zinc and then Z-Pak and some other supplements as needed, what he discovered just didn't have any money in it. And if it had been adopted, we never would have had a vaccine because we never would have had emergency use authorization for a vaccine because you can't get one if a disease can be effectively treated. So Zev, you know, ran right into the same problem that's been run into by innovative people for centuries. And, you know, there's a famous story about Tucker and his automobile in the middle of the last century and all the innovations he came up with and how the large auto companies crushed him for it. Zev faced a similar problem with regard to his treatment for the pandemic. And a lot of people died unnecessarily. Quick statistic, at the time of his passing, Zev had overseen the treatment for approximately 7,500 pandemic sufferers with only three deaths. You can sort of drop the mic on that statistic.
Yeah, it's even much better than I think the vaccinated have been doing because with the COVID vaccine, contrary to how it was sold to us, you can still die from COVID if you have the vaccine.
Yeah, you still can. And the side effects have been really something. One of the things we illustrate in the book is how before the vaccine was rolled out, all of the various side effects, the vaccine injuries, as we've come to call them, all of them were known by the pharmaceutical companies ahead of time. And they were all shared with the FDA. They just weren't shared with the public. But they were shared, and it's all, you know, legitimate, real stuff. And we've got that information in the book. And I think people will be shocked, you know, when I put that part of the book together and I went through the list of side effects or injuries that were anticipated. I know at least one person personally who has suffered one of those injuries, all of them across the board. So that's how accurate the list was. And they knew it in advance.
Did you run into any resistance trying to get this book published?
No, you know, we're really grateful to the folks at Amazon who are, you know, the book's been up for a couple of weeks and we haven't had any issue. And we know there's been issues in the past with other writers on politically incorrect subjects, I guess. But no, we haven't. We worked with Perucci Publishing to get the book put together and ready to go into print. And Stephanie Perucci did just a beautiful job for us. And somebody who is, you know, like-minded. So I think in this day and age, you know, you pick your vendors, based on competence, and then B, based on making sure they, you know, see the world in a way similar to you so they'll fight for you and do the things that are needed. And Perucci Publishing did that. Everybody can get the book by going to zelenkobook.com. And here's what I would like to share with you and your audience, is that this book, every penny of the proceeds from its sale will go to the Zelenko Freedom Foundation. The last thing that Zev did before he passed away was to establish a foundation to carry on his work. It is ably run by Ann Vandersteel and Kevin Jenkins as the co-chairs. And the book is actually owned by the foundation, and all of the proceeds go to the foundation. So when you buy a book, hopefully you get a good read, and you can know you're going to get support a good cause.
Yeah, great Christmas present too. Coming right up to that season, and it's also a season for charity, so you get two birds with one stone in this case.
That's right. And by the way, speaking of Christmas, not only do we want you to buy a book for yourself, and not only do we want you to buy some for your friends, but we also want everybody to buy one for their local library. You know, it's a hope that in every town across the country, we have at least one person that wants to buy a book. And if they do, buy one for your local library and donate it. You know, libraries aren't going to get these books otherwise. It's actually a great idea from our publisher, Perucci Publishing. And I think it makes a lot of sense. So buy one for yourselves, buy them for your friends, and then buy one to donate to your local library and support the foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to get this message about science fact out there versus, I guess, political science. I was about to say science fiction, but that's something different altogether. But this political and financial science, I guess, where this idea is just because an idea works and it's not profitable, we should suppress it. I thought we were beyond that.
Oh no, we'll never be beyond acting like humans, unfortunately.
All right, Brent Hamacek, appreciate you being on the Silk or Joe Show today. And again, the book is titled Zelenko: How to Decapitate the Serpent. You can go ahead and get that right there from zelenkobook.com. And listeners, appreciate you being on the Silk or Joe Show today. We are done with the program. Our own website is mainstreetradionetwork.com. Feel free to check them out as well. Find out about this show and the Alan Nathan Show up there. And also, you can find Silk or Joe Show on social media at GETTR.com at Silk or Joe Show. Be seeing you.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.